Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with something, you know.
I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
Hello and welcome to the latest and somewhat different edition of the Penguin Podcast. I'm not Richard E. Grant. I'm in fact Marcus Speller from the Football Ramble, and I'm here with my usual outfit of Jim Campbell.
Hello.
Luke Moore.
All right.
And Pete Donaldson.
Good afternoon.
So for those of you who might not be familiar with the Football Ramble, it's a podcast about football in which we ramble. And we've now turned our ramblings into a book, also called The Football Ramble. For this special Penguin podcast, we will obviously be talking about football, and we'll also be hearing some clips from the audio edition of the new book. And of course, as with all of Penguin's guests, we've all brought in some important objects with us to the studio that have proved significant to our careers. If you can call them careers, chaps.
Our burgeoning careers.
We were allowed in the building, and that's the best it's going to get for me, yeah. I think.
I mean, that's the pinnacle. Being allowed in a building.
Yeah, someone showing you into a room and giving you a cup of tea.
But first up, football and books. Perhaps not a subject with the finest literary tradition. There are some good football books,
yes.
For those who are not aware. There are some not so good football books.
In which camp do we find ourselves, is the question.
We'll wait and see. I think coming down on the side of the good football books, one that springs to mind for me is All Played Out by Pete Davis, which actually was re-released as a book called One Night in Turin. And he spent a lot of time out in Italy for World Cup 1990 and talks about the implications of how it was received and what happened and how that went on to form the Premier League as we now know it indirectly, but also the fan trouble and all the drama that happened with Paul Gascoigne's tears and all that stuff. For me, that sticks in the mind as an excellent football book.
1990, of course, was a great one for England football fans because you Gascoigne, Lineker, Waddle, Barnes, those types of players in England actually did pretty well. So even in the name of nostalgia, it's a good one.
Exactly.
And also, I guess, you know, football autobiographies are an obvious genre of that type of book. And obviously there are lots of terrible ones, but some of the standout ones, Diego Maradona's is an incredible book because obviously he was an incredible man, and it sort of encapsulates what a lot of us love about football, which is that he had this incredible skill that was like verged on artistry, but was also just this fascinating and basically absurd character.
Troubled.
So the collision of that makes it such an entertaining read. I imagine that's the sort of book that people would like, even if they're not that into football, just because you just have to marvel at the man's decision. Decision-making process.
But it kind of transcends the sport, doesn't it? A character like Diego Maradona. Yeah. It's a bit like you wouldn't have to be into basketball to read Michael Jordan's autobiography.
Absolutely, or Muhammad Ali.
Yeah, exactly.
But if you like basketball, that would be utterly irrelevant.
But with Maradona's one, his phrase or choice of words or turn of phrase is so ridiculous, you think to yourself, his ghostwriter had one hell of a task.
Yeah, well, the ghostwriter actually says that there are specific phrases that look like they've been strangely translated about to point out, no, when he says he let the dog, what is it? He let the tortoise get away from him is when someone's missed an opportunity, or he should give the dog his face back is when someone's been a hypocrite. They are at pains to go, these are not sayings. These are things only he said.
He almost like talks with his own language. But Sir Alex Ferguson has also written, in my view, one of the best autobiographies, Managing My Life. But he also written one of the worst as well in his second edition, much later in his career, which seemed to be written for a lot more of a broad audience and really not that good. But the first, it's as bad as the first one is good. I mean, the first one is absolutely superb. Yeah. His story is such an interesting one.
Sort of like a book of two halves if we're using football cliches.
The first one stops when they win the treble. Manchester United win the treble in 1999, and that's when the first book stops, and the second book starts a lot, it obviously comes on a lot later and was only released a few years ago. But so one man has actually written one of the best and one of the worst in my view, certainly.
But isn't that indicative of a career dealing with PR and dealing with kind of keeping everything in the dressing room and stuff like that? It's going to translate at the end of the day.
Yeah, because there's so much more attention on it these days, even when compared to when he wrote that book, which would have been in the summer of 1999. Mm. Clearly, he felt like he was much more able to get away with being honest and a lot more forthright with his opinions, something for whatever reason he didn't feel like could be got away with in 2014 or whatever it was.
Yeah. Also, as well, after that, it's the pinnacle of his career, really, so he's sort of invincible in a different way.
Well, you know, hopefully the book isn't the pinnacle of our career. We hope that there's a lot more to come.
I've been very honest about Alex Ferguson in it, so...
Yeah, you have.
Well, I was that's very giving of me, I think.
We were very forthright with our opinions.
Yeah, exactly.
And unlike Diego Maradona, we do use phrases and words that you will understand.
In common parlance,
that's right. Well, let's hear a clip from our book, The Football Ramble, our fantastic book, if I may say so.
Yeah, I mean, even if you're not a football fan,
you should buy 100 copies.
Yeah, hopefully there will be something in here for you as more of a sort of general broad chat about the phenomenon that is football and the entertainment that goes along with it and the relationship between it and things like the media and other bits and pieces. There should be something of interest in there for you.
Well, it's like our love letter to it that's also about it.
Of course.
I mean, certainly from my perspective, I don't read a lot of football books. I find them very kind of small-minded, and they don't really talk about the culture outside of football. Mm-hmm. I think that's something that we've always said that we would do if we ever got a book deal. And we got book deals, so that's what we're doing. So
we stuck to our task.
And often football mirrors society, and there's a much bigger thing, as you say, going on. If you don't like football, we think that's a shame, perhaps. Mm. But here's Jim with the start of his chapter in the book called Fans.
People who don't like football have no idea what they're missing. They think they do, but they don't. They'll often take pride in not liking it, wearing a look that suggests they think they should be heralded as free-thinking mavericks when they reveal that actually they don't care about 22 millionaires kicking a ball around as if they're Stuart Lee, when in fact they're Stuart Lee, your cousin's new IT consultant boyfriend who you're sat next to at a wedding. Fair enough though, Stu. Nobody has to like anything. Even so, you don't know what you're missing. Most of us start off as kids. In terms of following football, that is. We all start off as kids. Apart from FIFA executives. Most of them seem to have been born despicable old men, maybe even hatched. Anyway, most fans are indoctrinated by a parent or support their local team because they live in a one-club town. Others pick a team when they discover football at school, and yet more get into it because they had a grandparent, uncle or dog who lived in Manchester, Liverpool or Barcelona. Every school had one, depending on who's winning at the time. Whatever your choice and however you make it, it's with you forever, like a cool-looking scar or cold sores.
Jim with his section from his chapter called Fans. We're all fans of the game.
Yeah, that's where this story starts, isn't it, really? I mean, we all came together as a group because we're fans of football first and foremost, and that's really what underpins everything we're doing now.
I think I joined the Ramble because I had access to radio studios, so I think that's very much...
Yeah, you were very much a tactical move.
Yeah.
Pete, you say that, Pete, but in many ways, we're talking about just being fans. You're the man who goes to just as many games as the rest of us, if not more. You follow Newcastle fairly closely for a Londoner, I would suggest.
Yeah, I try and get to as many, certainly, London away matches. I just like the whole... I like the pageantry of it all, and I always have. I've always liked attending games. It's not necessarily about what happens on the pitch. For example, the story that I deal with in the book a couple of times is a man eating an advent calendar at Fulham once, sharing an advent calendar with his son. It was only like the 10th of December. That's the annoying thing. Wow. Maybe they just got it from Tesco's.
How decadent.
my earliest memory of being a football fan is going to Fratton Park, which is where Portsmouth play, where I'm from, the team I support, with my uncle, who's sadly passed on now. But he first introduced me to the excitement of going to a game. Because everyone sees football on TV. Now, I know back when we were a bit younger, football wasn't on TV as much as it is now, but you're still aware of it. You know the football's there.
That's right.
It's only when you go to a game for the first time, especially if you go at a very impressionable young age, that you think, wow, this is something really special. Mm. I can remember the whole crowd almost feeling like there was one, like it was one organism. And for me, after that, it wasn't even like I was hooked, like the whole cliche people say I was hooked. For me, it just seemed completely impossible for football to not be a part of my life from that on. It was like, why would you never want to be a part of that?
I think a lot of people think that, you know, that football is just another part of their life in the same sense that being at school is a part of your life growing up and going to work is a part of your life. Yeah. But the example you're using there about Portsmouth is a very traditional kind of working class kind of thing. And Pete, actually, before you used to go and watch Newcastle, you would go and watch Hartlepool. Again, a much more kind of local kind of feel. But Jim, you are an Arsenal fan.
Yeah.
If you go and watch Arsenal now, it'll cost about £60 or something.
Yeah, it's an incredibly expensive.
Very, very different experience, and one that actually turns a lot of people off football.
Indeed. And also, I mean, Arsenal are a great example because if things aren't going well, the fans get frustrated that they're paying so much and it sort of poisons the atmosphere a little bit as well. So it's definitely it's a strange modern phenomenon.
But as the Arsenal fans, can you understand when people say, because it happens more and more these days, oh, I've fallen out of love with the game anymore. There's nothing there for me anymore.
Absolutely. I mean, I've certainly been in a situation where I've been to a game and it's cost me maybe 50 quid, which is pretty much the cheapest ticket you can get. I remember watching us draw 0-0 with Fulham. Andre Arshavin ran about as much as I did. And I was just thinking, like, it's not like I ever regretted going, and I would happily pay to support my team, as I will do in the future and probably for as long as I live. But for me, I think being a fan of football is actually also so much more, or about so much more than the game itself. I think of it as being football with a capital F, almost like it's a universe that you invest in the same way you do like in like the Star Wars movie universe. You know, it's about the characters in the game as well, and all those yeah. mad funny little things that happen when, you know, you get these men who are professional athletes who are then suddenly very rich, very famous, and they behave in ways that are very weird, and as I'm sure we all would. And I sort of love that kind of pantomime soap opera element of it as well.
And of course you explore that in your chapter
very much
fans
so. Yeah.
in the book.
I think that's what bonds us as far as, just because the four of us don't really take the game too seriously, do we? I don't really remember any of us getting fully angry about something within the game. We sort of try and see it for what it is, a pastime essentially, and the humour around it is something that you always need to keep sight of.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And it teaches a lot about temperance, about humility, about the fact that things aren't always going to go your way. Mm-hmm. I think football could teach a lot of people a lot of things about themselves in many ways.
Indeed. We're going to move on to the first of our objects that we've brought in. And it's funny you talk about people falling out of love with the game. I've brought an item along which a lot of people have fallen out of love with in this country. It's an England kit. It's actually a Euro 2012 England kit, a big three lions badge in red. Often it's in a kind of a navy blue and whatnot. Mm. And it's a long sleeve jersey as well.
Right. It's quite a nice one looking back at it.
Yeah.
They change them an awful lot these days.
It's a good one. It's a sort of modern classic that I would sort of go as far to say. But the reason why I brought that in is in the section of the book I wrote the foreword, I talk quite a bit about England or international tournaments, certainly. Mm. And that was the first love for me. I came in 1990 as a young sort of 7 or 8 year old at the time. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it. That was when my love of football was really ignited. And it was England. And England got to a semi-final of a competition. And 6 years later got to another semi-final of a competition and looked like they could have won it.
And we, at the time, we all thought we were underachieving.
Yeah.
That's right. Insane, isn't it?
I remember it well. And at that point, when we went out in the semi-finals to West Germany on penalties, it felt like a missed opportunity.
Mm. Huge.
Whereas if it happened now, it would feel like we'd already won. Anything we get now is a bonus because we are so poor now that if we got to that level, it would be just a huge success, whatever the circumstances.
Yeah. But I picked this. I mean, there was a number of England kits I own, and I could have brought them. But that actually was the first time, because we went as a group to Kiev, to Ukraine, right, during that tournament, and that was the first time I'd seen England in a tournament match.
Mm.
And what a collector's item it was. They played Sweden and won 3-2. I mean, to see a 5-goal thriller involving England and England being on the right side of it in a tournament, my goodness.
We hadn't beaten Sweden in a long time in a tournament, had we? I think maybe even ever at the time.
They were a bogey side.
Something like that, wasn't
they? They were a bogey side for England, certainly. But for me, international football is still the pinnacle of the game. I know I part ways with a lot of people there, and I understand that because the Champions League is often seen as the best level and arena of football. But international football is slightly different. But the feeling of being at a tournament, watching your team and interacting with fans from all around the world and so on, it's so good. To me, it brings out the best and worst, granted, of people in football. But that's where, to me, it's at its best. So, yeah, my item there, the England kit of Euro 2012. But it could have been of a number of different tournaments. Of course, right, let's get back to our book. And this is a clip from the opening chapter, all about the history of the game, also written by Jim Campbell.
Yep.
Jim, you're up again.
Tried to monopolise it.
He didn't write all of it.
Written a whole book, but most of it was cut.
Yeah. And we had to pick up the slack, right?
Yeah. So what is it exactly about balls?
There's something irresistible about balls. If a ball is nearby, then every atom of you is compelled to bounce it, throw it, or kick it. It calls to you like a mysterious orb made of pure fun. You don't know why, you sometimes don't even notice it happening, but you just need to play with it. Much is written about how football began, about who invented it, and at what point it became enough like the game we have today to be considered football. Maybe it exists because it has to. Something about us needs to kick around a spherical object, and football has evolved so that we can satisfy this urge.
Its true beginnings probably come from our ancient ancestors kicking fruit about, because when there's a roundish object on the ground, something inside us just has to absolutely leather it. Even as a 34-year-old man, I'm still tempted by every stray bottle cap I come across. In fact, I once broke my toe attempting to kick one, but that's a story for another book. Kicking things is fun. Throw in an objective like scoring to give it some competitive purpose, and you have a sport.
That was from the chapter History by Jim in the Football Ramble book. It's true. When you see a spherical object, you have to kick it.
Yeah.
As long as it won't like break your foot if it's made of concrete.
My earliest kind of footballing memory going to St James's Park, obviously my home stadium, wasn't even about the beating of Aston Villa. 1-0, Les Fernand header. It's all in the book. All in the book. Yeah. But it was actually on the walk up to those that famous kind of graying St James's Park building stadium thing. A man drunkenly tried to kick a can. But he was so drunk he missed and fell on his behind. And I'd never seen a grown man.
You thought this day's already a success?
I thought, yeah, exactly. I don't care what happens in the football. Yeah. This man has made a fool of himself thanks to gravity and alcohol.
Yeah, today's already a win.
Yeah, exactly. And later on, I picked up the particular baton and indulged in that sort of thing myself. Yes. But yeah, it was
excellent.
Really, you know.
And one of the things I found great about the book we wrote is that the process involved, because we all took different chapters and different areas of the game. So for me, reading what you guys had written was new. It was all very new. And in the history chapter, Jim, was there anything that sticks out particularly that was really surprising or fascinating or interesting? I imagine quite a lot of it, because you had to condense essentially 1,500 years or whatever of history into the beginning of the game as we know it into one chapter. So there must have been loads of stuff in there that you found fascinating.
Absolutely. For me, the stuff before actual football as we know it formed, because the Chinese had a sport called Kuju, which FIFA recognises as basically the first football. And it's actually pretty amazing how similar the game was in a lot of senses. I mean, it did change to almost become like a sort of cross between kind of volleyball and a few other sports, but It had professional clubs. It had a professional league. Like that's they're seen as the first professional clubs all over the world. And it was around for a long, long time, way longer than football's ever been. And it's incredible to basically think that a similar thing to this has happened before.
It doesn't surprise me, though. It reminds me of, I think it was Brian Robson, who said if football didn't exist, we'd all be very frustrated footballers.
Yeah.
It is that thing, going back to what you said about kicking balls and whatnot.
Yeah.
It just seems, for most people on the planet, quite a natural thing to do.
It's a danger to have a ball in your house, isn't it? Stuff's going to get broken because you can't help yourself. But as well as that, there was also kind of in England, mob football, as it was known, where entire towns would play against each other, and you'd win a game by getting a version of a ball onto your rival town's church balcony in some cases.
I mean, it was a pig's
property
bladder.
Damage was rife. It was completely normal, and it was properly lawless, and it just sounds like absolute chaos. And
it was like a riot dressed up as a football
match. It was, but actually sometimes they were organised as a pretext to riot.
But it is incredible when you think about how that was the origins of the game to what we have now.
To goal line technology.
It is absolutely incredible, the rise of the game in relatively a small period of time in historical terms. It's fascinating. Mm. This multi-billion pound industry.
And it seems to be developing faster and faster the more we move through because there's more opportunity for it, because there's a bigger audience, because people get better at marketing, because there's more money, all that stuff. And it's just getting faster and faster.
Yeah. And more abstract, I'd say. If an alien came down now and went, why have you tidied this whole mob football thing up?
Yeah, that was great.
And why are you selling it to people?
Yeah.
Why are you selling it to people? Why are people buying it? It's so kind of homogenised and tidy.
But one of the things we have in our locker as Englishmen, I suppose, is the fact that we do have the Football Association
who
claim that they invented it, but actually, essentially what they did, as we found when researching the book, they formalised it and made it more about, typical British, more about rules and doing things the right way. Mm. And that's the playbook now, isn't it? That's where it all sprang from, around the late 19th century or whatever.
Rugby league and also eventually Aussie rules all sprang from breakaways into different codes from that one meeting where all that was standardised. So that's a productive afternoon.
Yeah.
Again, one of the fascinating things about the historical side of it was how many sort of similar games popped up in different civilizations who couldn't possibly have known about each other all over the world. Like in South America, in a region called Mesoamerica, they would use like rubber balls, because obviously they had rubber trees, so that they'd be solid rubber, and you'd play it with your hip, and players would die from internal bleeding just from playing the game as it was supposed to be played, because the ancient world was brutal.
And it was about, if you won the game, in some cases you would be sacrificed. And that
was if you lost the game.
The
captain or sometimes the whole team, depending on the lunar cycle, would be sacrificed.
Right.
But that was a great honour.
Right. I would give half the Newcastle squad to the gods at certain times during the season, quite happily.
I'm sure Mike Ashley, the club's owner, wouldn't agree. Yeah. Or maybe he would. We'll have to get in touch with him. And let's move on to our next object. This is your object, Pete. It's a match day ticket.
It is a match day ticket, yeah. You know when you're sort of looking for something in particular, it's actually quite hard to kind of locate it in your house.
Especially if it's that small.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I found that in my drawer. That is a ticket from the old Berlin ground, the old West Ham ground, when I went to see Newcastle play and I was in the away section. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned a little story in the book where I'm leaving after the match finished. I think Newcastle may have won 1-0 or maybe 2-1. It doesn't really matter. But either way, we're walking past the head of like a Muslim organisation. Mm-hmm. And knowing football fans, they're idiots. They're frequently a little bit right-wing. They're frequently silly. But not always, obviously. And we're all walking past. And you can see that outside this Muslim association, it's an association that runs pretty much all the mosques in the south of England. And they've got two burly blokes kind of posted on the front. So that if anyone, you know, starts trouble or throws anything or says anything, mm-hmm. they've got a little bit of protection. And it gets a bit quiet. Mm-hmm. There's a bit of an atmosphere forms. And it's a little bit, not upsetting, just a bit ominous. You think sure. that someone's going to shout something because people do.
And football fans, as you say, can be very insensitive. Exactly. And can cause ugly scenes.
So we're walking past one of the biggest Muslim associations of the UK, and one lad shouts, or starts to shout, the word Muslims, and I bristle. I'm like, here we go. I've got to pretend I'm not part of this this throng of Geordies.
Again.
Your Honour.
I'm going to commando roll into this car. But his actual chant was, Muslims are a Geordie, Muslims are a Geordie. It's the whole kind of like, manager's name is a Geordie, so-and-so is a Geordie.
He's one of us.
Yeah, so Muslims are a Geordie. Yeah. And I've never been...
Did everyone start singing along?
Everyone started singing along. The whole crowd was singing Muslims are a Geordie, which is a beautiful kind of, especially in the northeast of England, which is not always thought of as being particularly temperate, you know what I mean?
The ticket itself's got a grease stain on it.
Pie.
Okay, I genuinely was interested.
It was pie. Yeah.
Do you like a match day pie?
I do like a match day pie. Well, I used to work for Leicester City Football Club back at Filbert Street.
Yeah,
they were champions, let's make that very clear.
Played your part.
Set the foundations. Yeah. But I used to work for Leicester City and I used to serve pies. So I know exactly how delicious they can be.
Yeah, indeed.
Because we didn't sell all of them every day. We used to be able to walk home with them because you can't sell them again like 2 weeks later.
Certainly not.
I imagine some football clubs might well do that.
In the book itself, there's a fascinating passage where I go into the foil codes on the pies. Chicken balti, red.
Don't give it away, man. It's a spoiler.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Foil is chicken and mushroom.
Yeah, it's a spoiler.
And it goes on like that, really.
You and your fascinating passages. See, this was obviously, as you said, at the Bowling Ground, or Upton Park, as people often refer to it, West Ham's old stadium. The stand you were in was the Bobby Moore Upper, which is lovely, isn't it, when you think, I mean, that's named after the great Sir Bobby Moore, and you think where West Ham are now in the old Olympic Stadium, or the sort of old Olympic Stadium, new Olympic Stadium. Mm. I suppose
it's
both
new
are
in the
London
memory,
Stadium.
Did you guys?
Well, it is the old Olympic Stadium because it's not currently
the former Olympic Stadium.
Then maybe that's more accurate. All right, chaps, it's time to hear something else from our audiobook of the Football Ramble. This time, it's a chapter that isn't written by Jim. Luke, you did the honours for this one, called Media. Plenty to talk about here, but let's hear a clip first.
Football has gone from a pastime conducted on a Saturday afternoon in your local area with like-minded individuals to an ever-present, ever-evolving 24-hour pantomime set inside a huge circus, and the modern media has made it impossible for any of us to miss a single beat. From 24-hour rolling news channels all over the world to the internet, and from more than 150 live games shown each season just in the top flight in England alone, to countless radio phone-ins, YouTube channels and fan forums, we truly now live in the football age. It permeates every level of our discourse and consciousness. It's a wonder any of us get anything done. In fact, thinking about it, do we actually get anything done? Maybe that's why the economy's in the toilet and it has been since 2008. It wasn't a financial crisis. It was football's ability to finally invade every single part of our collective lives and stop us concentrating on the important stuff. We should probably start thinking about how to sort it out. Problem is, I'm way too busy watching backheel goals from the Argentinian second division on Vine to dedicate any time to it at the moment. It's probably possible to conclude that these days the media is almost as important as the game itself. One can hardly exist without the other. Football owes its very livelihood to the money it receives from TV networks, and, at the last count, that amounted to just over £5 billion for the right to show the Premier League from 2016 to 2019 in the UK alone. With those TV networks then subsequently beholden to the amount of subscriptions and viewers they can attract, both rely on the other for their very survival.
That was taken from the chapter Media in the Football Ramble book by Luke Moore. The media machine that is alive and very well in football is quite something to behold. Do we belong to it?
Very much so.
Yeah, I think we do, and
we've sort of snuck into it.
Yeah, through the back door maybe.
But we don't make stowaways. Any money.
But we are stowaways in the media machine.
That's something that becomes sort of quite apparent when I was writing, actually, because you go through all the traditional media, and it was quite interesting to look at how radio first, then newspapers, and then television got involved in football and realised that it was popular. And then you obviously naturally, chronologically move through how the media interacts with football. Mm-hmm. And towards the end of the chapter, I did realise that actually we are very much a part of it. Yeah. Because I start talking about things like YouTube channels and fan forums and internet and its relationship and with the game. And you are a part of it. You almost find yourself commenting on yourself. And we talk about this all singing, all dancing machine of football media, 365 days a year, 24 hours a day. And, you know, we're very much part of that.
And when you do a podcast like we do, or anything in the game, when you're talking about what's going on, you need to keep up with it because so much stuff can happen in a day.
Yeah.
Inevitably, it doesn't, but it can do. And you find yourself drawn into these kind of 24-hour rolling football news outlets and so on and so forth, and you sit there going, man, this is the death of news at one point, but at another point, you are watching it, aren't you?
Yeah, and also, I mean, people within it, they almost cease to feel like real people. Like Mario Balotelli feels like a fictional character out there doing all these things for the benefit
of
us.
Or just a character from a film or something.
Yeah,
like
absolutely, yeah.
The problem that football may have in the future, and I'll talk about this elsewhere in the book, actually, is that its very popularity is intrinsically based on the fact that it's at its heart a simple game. So the fact if you want to go out into the park over the back of your house with your pals and a ball, you can essentially replicate, in your own mind at least, whatever you want to replicate. And when football keeps going on that relentless quest for commercialism, for more money, for more accountability when it comes to laws and rules like video replaying, that sort of stuff, they have to, I'm not going to get into the debate whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, but they have to be careful that they're not going to change it so intrinsically that it becomes something that people on the street don't recognise anymore. Mm. And I think a lot of people, as we talked about earlier, just with Jim, about people being turned off by the game, I think a lot of people feel like that moment might have already come.
Do you think it's getting to the point where kids are nicking their dad's shaving foam to take it down the park and use it as vanishing spray?
Yeah.
You're going to need more and more accessories.
I don't think we've got to that yet, but I do say the word yet. I think with football, you're right, look, it's a very simple game. But yet people try and add so many layers onto it. And you see it with computer games as well. They're a big one where people almost say, live out your reality through this. But actually, the game is what really we all care about. You know, you can recreate things, you can have different clips and whatnot. But when you, and Pete, you're big on this as well, and rightly so, I think we all are. In any kind of media outlet, whether it's a commentator, a pundit, someone who's created, as I say, a game or whatever it may be, if you think for a second that you are more important than a substitute sitting on the bench of a lower league club who's actually playing the game, then you're in trouble.
Mm. And I think accessibility for me was quite big in my stadium chapter, for example. The provision for disabled supporters is obscene. And some of the worst offenders are some of the league's leaders, like Liverpool's not great. I know it's an old stadium, stuff like that. But if you can't provide a provision for a certain amount or a certain percentage of disabled people, you should shut to the ground because it's not fit for purpose. I go on at length about the fact that I'm proud to use the tube every day. But something like, I think it's something like 60% of the tube network disabled people can't use. Mm. So if you can't provide football to everyone who could possibly enjoy it, you're failing and you shouldn't be allowed into the game. You shouldn't be allowed to make money off the game when you're excluding supporters whose money is as good as everyone else's.
On the media relationship thing, I mean, part of the reason it becomes even more complicated is because actually the reason that it's happening, the reason this commercial stuff is going on, and the reason that it is relentless with this coverage is because people still consume it.
Yeah.
But they wouldn't. There's no way money men, brands, commercial people would be funding and sponsoring big projects, whether they be media related or football themselves related, if people weren't consuming it, if they weren't getting a return on that investment. So in actual fact, it's the general public and their relentless, I keep using the word relentless, but it really is, and their sort of incessant need for more and more football coverage and interaction with the game.
And Jim, on that as well, you know, when people, you know, like us, we do a show and you have people who do other football shows that people absolutely love. Sometimes, like I said earlier, they get a little bit ahead of themselves and one has to watch oneself because it's the game we care about.
Absolutely.
If certain podcasts or even if Match of the Day ceased to exist, we all love Match of the Day dearly, people would still go and watch football. What you really want to know is, who scored the goals and how did they look and how did the game play out? And then from that, everything else comes.
Yeah, I think the explosion of the interest in it as well that Luke's touched on there is so much down to the explosion of the internet, which means that you know people in other countries can see the quality of the leagues in Europe, and it's become popular in the USA and obviously in China it's become really, really big. So it's just sort of evolved with that, isn't it? It's most of the audience for the Premier League isn't based in England. Like it's insane. I touch on in the book. Man United estimate they've got 100 million fans in China. That's way more than the population of Britain.
It's incredible. But you know, we're talking about all this internet coverage or media coverage as well. It's great in another sense because
it's truly global, and it's the first time that a sport has been able to be that.
Yeah.
And what's interesting as well as Luke touched on again, like it is important that we keep it simple because it has the same fundamental aim as those ancient games that we were talking about. That it's, you know, where it's come from, this sort of primal need in a sense. And it's tempting to look at it and think the bubble will burst, but the world is so massive that I guess it's just about the Premier League in particular. I guess maintaining its quality and its appeal, isn't it? Because people are going to want a slice of this pie. You know, other leagues are going to say, how can we appeal to China and appeal to the USA in the same way?
Yeah, if you're living 3,500 miles away from a team that you quite like watching, I mean, you're now able to watch them.
Exactly.
In some cases, it's easier for you to watch them than it is for us here.
And of course, football clubs, if they've got any sort of marketing nous about them, because that seems to be a huge part of it, know that they need to get out there to bigger countries and to bigger populations to make as much money as they can. But at the same time, that's key to their success as well on the field, because that gives them more budget and more chance to get better players. I conclude the chapter by essentially suggesting that both things are sort of almost intertwined, and it's unable to separate them now. They're clearly so intertwined that, you know, the clubs have got their own channels, their own TV stations, all that sort of thing, and that's essentially where the game is going.
And that's it. Both intertwined. The media is very much a part of football.
Yeah.
Let's move on to the next object. It's Jim's hat.
It is my hat. Yeah, it's a hat that you guys bought me for my birthday because it happened to fall while we were in Kiev for Euro 2012. And I've got to be honest, guys, it strikes me as a bit of a panic buy. But I...
How dare you?
Hang on a minute. Were you happy with it?
Yeah.
It's a great hat.
Yeah.
Why are you wearing it today if you're not happy with it?
I love it.
It's clearly for the cold weather, and indeed, we're enjoying a nice, relatively warm autumn so far.
If you can't picture what I mean, it's the sort of Soviet hat that one of Arnold Schwarzenegger's sort of one of the people he mows down in one of his movies would probably wear.
Yeah.
It's got those big sort of earmuff things. And what it reminds me of is kind of how lucky we've been actually to go abroad and see some of the games that we have. Because as well as going to Kiev in 2012, we also went out to South Africa in 2014 and we've done some quite cool trips. And for me, writing the fans chapter in particular, I wanted to draw on those experiences. We have been very, very lucky. But I think when writing that chapter, I wanted to get across, I wanted to sort of almost aim it at those people who think football is sad and who will tar you with a particular brush for liking football and make assumptions about you. And
when you mean say sad, you mean sort of like tragic and
sort of. There is definitely a nerdiness to being a football fan, but I think that's to be embraced for one thing. And one of the things people say quite often is, it doesn't matter, it's pathetic to care about it, it's just 22 millionaires kicking the ball around, blah blah blah. And it is all that, but it is important why it is you're frustrated or upset if your team lose. And I think that's a very interesting thing about being a fan, because you don't really choose that, do you? You care because you just do.
A friend of mine, very, very intelligent man, he's absolutely obsessed with Liverpool. He takes it actually personally when Liverpool are beaten, to the point of where and it's happened in the past, I'm not coming to the pub tonight, I just don't feel like it. When Liverpool won the Champions League in 2005.
You didn't say for 3 weeks.
He genuinely said to me, like, in a really heartfelt way, because I watched the game with him, this is the best night of my life.
And he spent it with you.
Otherwise, I'm not suggesting it's unintelligent to feel that way. I'm just saying it's curious because he's not an irrational man, is what I'm saying. Yeah. But football can bring that out
absolutely
in people.
We've all been lucky enough to be at various Champions League finals. And Marcus and I, we went to Rome, didn't we, to see Barcelona against Man United. And you guys saw, was it Dortmund against Bayern at Wembley?
Yeah, at Wembley, yeah.
Yeah. So we're very lucky to have experienced that. But the atmosphere in those grounds, especially when none of us have any association with those clubs, was phenomenal. I've never experienced anything like it. And it is a truly powerful thing. It's sort of it's this feeling that you can only really experience if you're invested in it. It's a whole biological process that a lot of people will never get to appreciate.
Well, it's funny, and going back to what you said, Luke, about your mate, the Liverpool fan, in the foreword, I mentioned something similar, actually. Now, that's only ever happened once to me, I think, and I mention it there. But it's true, football can just throw you sideways in a way that you would never even imagine. To me, that does sound like irrational behaviour, and that's too far.
But it's about belonging, isn't it? Because if you look at the fact that Leicester City just won the Premier League this last season, if you were going to bore that down, Leicester City fans who've supported that team for a long time through thick and thin, mostly thin, have now in a position where some of them will be taking almost personal credit for their team winning the Premier League title. Oh, we did this, we did that.
As they should, though, because they've spent so much time.
I'm not saying they shouldn't, but I'm just saying if you boil it down, have they actually done anything towards it? Other than obviously put their money in and go and support their team, which is important. But the point is, it's hard to think of anything else where you would so willingly take such a lot of credit publicly for something you haven't really done.
One of the things I touched on in this chapter, actually, is that, you know, football is something you love. So in a way, if you love it, you're sort of claiming to know about it. So when you support your team, you stake your reputation on them. So when you lose, people take laugh it very at you about hard, it. And hard, when you win, you, that's where you sort of get
bragging
that credit.
Yeah, bragging rights. It's always talked about, isn't it? It's always talked about local bragging rights, isn't it? Whenever a game, a local derby happens.
It certainly is. Okay, it's time to get back to our audiobook, The Football Ramble, and let's head to a chapter called Players that was penned by you, Pete. Why did you want to nab this one?
I think probably because I wanted to do the stadium chapter a lot, and then I thought, well, if I've done quite a dry subject and try to, you know, bring it to life a little bit, I thought players would be a little bit easier. So this is very much my dessert chapter.
I see.
The characters in the game is something you get to look at as your meat and drink.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Oh, it's fascinating.
You're saying meat and drink, he's saying dessert.
Yeah.
It's you know,
have them all on the same plate.
The full course, I would say.
Enjoy it.
Well, let's hear a clip now. And here you are pondering about the apparent chasm between mere mortals like you and me, more you, and professional footballers.
Footballers used to be like us. Broken, fallible, heart-on-the-sleeve humans who just so happened to have a decent left foot on them. They didn't need to commit to a life of riches and fame at the age of five. They were free to live a little. Maybe learn a trade on the side. Play a little non-league and get discovered while working as a sparky on a housing estate. Although I appreciate the sacrifices and devotion to the craft of the modern footballer, they have about as much in common with me as a Michelin-starred chef, a NASA engineer, Wonder Woman. Because of this, meeting your idol is invariably like sniffing a bottle of week-old milk. You know it's on the turn, you know you'll be wholly disappointed with the experience, but for some ridiculous reason, you want to make sure. Nowadays, the modern footballer is a well-drilled PR mini-mogul. They give toothy smiles to every potato-faced youngster they encounter, knowing any slip-up could lose them thousands, if not millions, of social media followers. They conduct every conversation with their manager behind a cupped hand, knowing there are thousands of cameras filling up millions of SD cards, each taking in every conceivable trajectory, positioned in every conceivable place. And that's before we get to the scourge of the camera phone.
That was a clip from the chapter Players by Pete Donaldson. Whenever anybody asks you, what would you do with your life if you could do anything? What job would you do? I always say, professional footballer.
Yeah,
now, I know that only leads you up to the age of 35, 36, 37 or something like that. But it's true. If I could have done anything with my life, it would have been professional footballer for the first, as I say, 37 years.
It's a common one, isn't it? And one that we all fall into fairly sort of lazily, I guess, by saying that. It's interesting, though, because I interviewed a troubled ex-professional footballer fairly recently. And he said one of the things that he finds fascinating and actually quite odd is that with all the increasing coverage that we've obviously just talked about earlier, so football fans only really consider the 2 hours between 3 and 5 on a Saturday and the 2 hours on a Tuesday night or whatever. Yet, in the reality, certainly in his experience, was, you know, a world away from that. That's essentially 4 hours a week.
Yeah.
The rest of the time, obviously training aside, and they don't do an awful lot of training in terms of comparing it to an everyday full-time job. So it's completely different. And it can be, not always, but it can be an absolute nightmare.
Well, it's such an intriguing profession. And in any sports profession really is, but football in particular, if you think about it, for the first, you know, say we're talking a very successful football career here, so between the ages of 18 and 36 you're making enormous money, you're playing in huge stadiums, people chanting your name, you're absolutely loved. After that, where do you go? It's not even like you can become, you know, like the Rolling Stones. Your best years are behind you, but you can still fill a stadium. You can still fill a stadium. What you do, you can still do what you do in an older man way. In football, it goes. And so those, I don't know, as I say, 15 odd years or whatever it may be, are so incredibly scrutinised and so lauded and so much written about them. It is a fascinating thing.
And having so much disposable income, but not really having anything to spend it on apart from just objects. You can't travel, really. You get a couple of weeks off in the summer, and they're usually just, you know, found in Dubai or Miami or LA or something like that. But for me, that would be the most frustrating thing.
Yes.
Not being able to escape and do your own thing.
Be like being a teacher.
It's insane. It's insane.
Well, it is like being at school, really, in a sense, as a professional
footballer. And some men and women need that regimen. But a lot of people can't handle it.
You essentially sign yourself up these days, particularly, to a life of that. Mm, and of course, it's not a terrible job, all things being equal. Mm. In the grand scheme of things, it's clearly not a woe is me story. Mm. But there are a lot of restrictions that aren't otherwise considered by the average football fan.
Where are you going to meet your wife or husband? Yeah. It's going to be a nightclub where all eyes are on you. Mm. There's going to be a certain criminal element that is going to gravitate towards you, so you've got to avoid that. There's going to be a certain type of person who's going to be attracted to the fame and fortune. So how do you weed that out? How do you not go insane when you're talking to someone who you think is just a normal person and you're just wondering about what are they going to hit me with that I'm going to be blindsided by?
And you struggle with that yourself, of course.
Exactly, obviously. But
he struggles to make friends. But I mean, the biggest thing that came out of that David Beckham documentary where he went away with some of his old school friends to South America because he'd never really travelled for exactly the reasons Pete's just listed. But he actually says at one point to the camera, I can't really make friends. I'm not able to do that because I don't really know what their motivation is. So that's why I'm here with all my really old friends. But in a way, there was something quite tragic and actually quite sad about that.
There is, but it's changed a lot, hasn't it, with footballers? Because footballers would drink down the pub. You know, people said they could have a chat with a footballer.
Well, Pete said that they'd have a trade and stuff as well.
Completely. Yeah. And you know, David Batty, I think it was David Batty, he used to do a few handyman jobs in the afternoon.
Stuart Pearce, maybe.
He was an electrician, wasn't he?
Yeah, because he never really thought of football as being a proper career.
But actually,
it's something, Jim, that we'll have those kind of stories going forward, because the vast riches of the top flight footballers are obviously thus that they don't need to. I know that not all footballers are on 100 grand a week. You know, you do have lower league footballers. And yes, it's a decent wage, of course, comparatively speaking.
You know, even teenagers at big clubs will be on, you know, thousands a week, which is insane. And it's so much more than most people learn.
Do you think that, you know, top players now are behind the velvet rope, if you like, and they are there to stay?
Yeah, I can't see wages ever decreasing now, but it's nothing new. People thinking that footballers are overpaid, that's pretty much always been the case, when they did sort of drink down the pub with the fans.
But I'm talking about that chasm between the fans. Do you think then that's it, that the footballers will always be inaccessible now?
Yeah, of course. And I think as well, another thing as a footballer, I guess you've got to have your eyes on, is if, say, you get a career-ending injury, which are, you know, are quite rare now, but still do happen, what else are you going to do? They don't learn how to do anything else, do they? And so after football, it becomes a bit of a problem. I wonder if now they earn so much that they can cushion themselves. But even then, there's pressure to make investments that mean in a short career, you know, you have to set yourself up for life with quite smart financial decisions that might not necessarily be your remit.
A lot of footballers appear to be, or even ex-footballers appear to be quite poorly financially advised. Yeah. I mean, the bankruptcy rate for ex-footballers is 4 or 5 times higher than the national average. Mm. But of course, I mean, I agree with Jim to an extent, but it's very difficult to see it going the other way. Because when people say to me, which it does happen fairly regularly, oh, footballers are overpaid, my answer is always the same, which is, well, where do you want the money to go?
Yeah.
Who do you think deserves the money more? Yeah. Because whether you like it or not, it's a £5 billion industry just with TV rights for the next 3 years in the UK alone. Mm. So who do you want to get that money?
It's also private money.
Well, this is it, Jim.
Players are really the only avenue you can give that money to because they make it all happen.
It's very true. It's time to move on to our next item. And we're looking at you now, Luke.
That's me.
The object that you brought in. What have you got for us?
Sorry about the rush here. Yeah, I've got. I've actually brought...
You've brought in... it's a bin bag by the looks of it. What's in the bin bag? That is what we're asking here.
Here we go.
He's well prepared.
It's a pair of Adidas Copa Mundial football boots.
Copa Mundials.
Got some mud on them as well. Mine, clearly well loved.
The boots I've had for about, I don't know, probably about 10 years now, maybe a bit longer.
So many strikers' skin cells on these studs.
Yeah.
You're
pass them around.
Your feet
pass them
down
around.
The back of their legs.
Fairly poor. If you smell them, they smell very authentic.
Fairly, well, they do.
Fairly irregularly used these days.
But this is a sign of the times as well, because I used to like Copa Mundials as well, and World Cups with this studded version. These are the Maldives for all you boots fans. And they're black, predominantly black boots.
Yeah. Yeah.
People think of referees wearing these boots now.
Yes.
Middle-aged man almost.
Someone wearing white boots in the Premier League used to seem like a real flash thing to do, didn't it?
These were like the go-to boots to have when we were younger. Yeah. And they're like wearing a pair of slippers. They really are. And the reason I brought them in is because I wrote a chapter about grassroots.
Indeed, yeah. Well, as you say yourself, that's definitely a cue to hear another clip from the audiobook of The Football Ramble. And this is you keeping it real.
For every Cristiano Ronaldo tantrum, Giorgio Chiellini slide tackle and Lionel Messi mazy run, there are several million of us trying and failing to replicate them on a bumpy pitch at playing fields all over the country every single week. Football at the grassroots level has its own style, though, its own unwritten rules and culture, and its own universe in which the players operate and function. I played football at what could accurately be described as the lowest level of organised football possible for years, and I honestly enjoyed every second of it. These days, although my playing days are behind me, I often head over to the playing fields near my parents' house on a Sunday morning when I'm visiting to watch the local league teams playing, usually in all weathers, with a huge amount of passion and enthusiasm for the game. What manifests itself almost every time is a hugely enjoyable, engrossing melodrama in which everyday men are cast in the role of hero, occasionally, villain, more often, and bit part accessory to both glory and failure on an almost minute-by-minute basis. I genuinely enjoy watching football at this level over any other for a mixture of reasons, including the fallibility of the protagonists, nostalgia, and realism. It is impossible to feel far removed from the game when you can hear and feel almost every kick from just a few yards away.
That was from the chapter Grassroots, written by Luke Moore. Grassroots football. We are all very familiar with that. We don't know what it's like to be a professional footballer or play in front of 50,000 people.
We know what it's like to pretend.
We know what it's like to pretend, and we know what it's like to go down the park on a Sunday morning or whatever it is with your mates playing in a team.
Well, the reason it's important, I felt, for me to write, I really was passionately wanting to write this chapter, is because for a good period of my life, I didn't actually get to watch an awful lot of games on that Sunday or sometimes on that Saturday afternoon because I would be playing. Yeah. I would be playing with my friends in a local team or whatever.
Yeah.
And that actually, when I started thinking about it, that's a big part of football. Mm. So people, we might write something in the book about, you know, going to the Champions League final. And as Jim said, we've been fortunate enough to do that. Not everyone's going to experience that.
The vast majority of people who will ever watch the sport won't visit
those games.
But people
will know what it's like to have a kick around. Absolutely. With their friends. And because you've got the referee there and the assistant referees, and you do feel like a part of it.
And grassroots football looks so different around the world as well.
Yeah.
It's absolutely wonderful. I think David Beckham said something quite nice. He said that, you know, England may well have created the game of football or formalised the rules of football. The heart of football, perhaps, maybe in England, I suppose one could say, in a slightly pompous way. But when he went to Brazil with Manchester United in that slightly strange World Club Championship, yeah, he said that he was on the beaches of the Copacabana and all around there with kids playing football and all the rest of it. And he went, this is where the soul of football is. Yeah. You know, I'm sure we all have stories of travelling abroad, just seeing grassroots football around the globe. As I say, the terrain can look different, the type of skills that maybe people prefer to play, but ultimately the essence is the same. Trying to recreate or just enjoy themselves.
Well, it is a recreation, because that's interesting to me, because the way that the professional game informs the Sunday league grassroots game is, yeah, actually very interesting. Mm. The players, no matter if they're adults or young kids, will want the boots that their favourite player wears. Yeah. They'll say things that they've heard older players or professional players when they've gone to a game say. Mm. And actually what exists is a big chasm between what people think they're able to do,
yes,
and what they're actually able to do.
Yeah.
So you'll go, I mentioned in the chapter, as I've just read, going into the playing fields over the back of my parents' house on a Sunday morning. I go for a walk over there and see people. Now, all these players, I'm not judging these players, because I'm one of them, or I was one of them. They're all fairly terrible footballers, right? Mm. If they weren't, they wouldn't be playing here.
Yeah.
But they still say stuff like, right, let's get our passing game going. Let's knock it about.
Yeah.
Let's turn on that. And they can't do that, because mm-hmm. they're not able to do that. But yeah, the most important thing is they're enjoying themselves, and that's what they want.
Well,
to
they
do.
Are recreating the acts of professional people. I mean, think about that if you did that in other walks of life. You know, people say, oh, he's a terrible handyman because he's trying to do the job of a professional electrician or something.
Yeah,
he can't do it.
Yeah.
And it's the same.
He's trying to build the house from scratch. It's already a house there. But one of the classic sort of types that you see in those sort of games is, we've all played with this guy, or indeed been him, the guy who just shoots from everywhere. Mm. That guy's a dreamer.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Mm. He's picturing those goals in his head, and he's just going to try and make it happen, regardless of how frustrating it is for everyone else who's available for a pass.
Well, I talk about the different types of grassroots football player you get in the book, and I break them down into parts, and he's definitely one of them.
But then, of course, on the professional level, you get someone like Cristiano Ronaldo, and it works out okay for him. But talking of, I suppose, is this the sweet spot between amateur and professional football? The England national team.
Yeah.
We haven't talked too much about them, for obvious reasons. We didn't want to depress you too early on in the podcast. But at the moment, the England national team are in a bit of a funny way. And it's funny, the history of the England national team, it's almost like football in this kind of microcosm. Yes, they've had a tiny bit of success, but really most of it's been a bit of failure and disappointment.
Yeah. The early days before success, we assumed that we were successful before internationals started to be played, because we had this whole idea that we'd invented the game.
Yes.
Then obviously a bit of vindication in 66 when we did win, and we've just been trying to live up to that ever since.
It really that was like flashpoint. Something that's happened from early on, because England refused to go to the early World Cups, didn't
they? Did,
they?
Yeah.
We're not really interested in that sort of stuff.
1950 was the first World Cup England, right, which was, I think, the fourth World Cup.
But I think up until, just as a casual observer, sort of been doing the show and enjoying football for the last however many years, I think up until maybe a few years, years ago, people thought, it's just a bit of a blip, you know, we'll be back out there soon.
Yeah.
And now people are starting to think, this is bad.
Yeah,
we've peaked.
Yeah. I mean, my you know, I didn't like football, I must admit, until I was about 14, 15. And my first World Cup was World Cup 94, which England weren't involved in. Mm. You know what I mean? So my heroes are Roberto Baggio and Romario and the Ireland football team and stuff like that. So, and then my chosen football teams were Hartlepool and Newcastle United. So, yeah. I mean, neither of them have had any success in my lifetime. I see the possibilities before me, but my love of football doesn't come from any sort of success. It just comes from, that was almost passable, wasn't it?
You do get used to it. Obviously, as a Portsmouth fan, that FA Cup win we had in 2008, I didn't sort of think to myself, great, now we're on our way. I thought, this is quite nice.
This is something
to last. But Marcus, you're the one who's always asking the questions. So I want to ask you a question.
Yes.
Can you foresee England winning a European Championship or a World Cup, the two big tournaments, in the next, say, 30 years?
Or if we get invited to the Copa America in South America.
Yeah.
this is the frustrating thing, because I can. But I think to myself, but it probably won't happen. That's the annoying thing about
it. Why do you
England.
Think it won't happen?
Because I'm a realist. You need to have a bit of good fortune at a tournament, but also you need to recognise some of the faults that are already there and have a bit of an overhaul of the national game, which England have talked about for so long. And I just don't see England being canny enough, being wise enough, being streetwise enough to get to a world.
To be humble enough.
To be humble enough could be the word there. I think the Premier League doesn't help the England national team in some senses. England is the only country, I would argue, where the quality of the National League is better than the national team. And I think that you see the quality week in, week out, and people are moving away from caring about the England team, which I didn't think would ever happen because people in this country cared about England for so long. I sort of choose to be realistic and say no, because it's the hope that kills you.
Yeah.
If that answers your question in any way. But that brings us to the end of the special edition of the Penguin podcast from the Football Ramble crew. It's goodbye from me. It's goodbye from you, Jim.
Yeah, goodbye.
Luke, say goodbye.
Goodbye.
Peter.
Goodbye, everyone.
It's been an absolute pleasure. For all the latest information about the Penguin podcast, you can follow at Penguin UK Books. And if you listen via Acast, you can see pictures of the objects we've been talking about. Cheerio.
Jamie Vardy, the free-scoring talisman behind Leicester City's Premier League title, has become an against-the-odds footballing hero the world over. Setting the record as the first player to score in 11 consecutive Premier League matches, he helped Leicester City beat odds of 5,000-1 to become champions. Defying all expectations, Jamie Vardy, the boy from nowhere, is simply one of the greatest sporting stories of all time.
I barged open the dressing room door, threw my shirt down and turned on the TV. I was raging. I couldn't sit down. There was a chair in front of me and I held on to the back of it, gripping it so tightly that my knuckles turned white. As the TV came to life, I watched a replay of the sending off from a camera at the opposite end of the ground. John Moss, the referee, was 40 yards away without a clear view, yet he decided that I dived. Not only that, but he couldn't wait to get his cards out. There was no thinking time. I heard the door open and assumed it was one of the staff. But Becky walked in. She was worried that I'd lose it and start rearranging the dressing room, and her instincts weren't far off the way I was feeling. It was the first time I'd been sent off as a professional footballer, and with only 4 matches remaining and the Premier League title in sight, the timing could not have been worse. Not that I was thinking that far ahead. A sense of injustice was burning inside me as I looked at my teammates running their bollocks off, trying to protect our 1-0 lead against West Ham. There was still more than half an hour remaining. It looked like we would hold on, but with 6 minutes to go, Moss decided that he wanted a bit more of the action. He penalised Wes for fouling Winston Reid in the area. Wes had his hands on Reid, granted, but the West Ham defender made a lot of it and flung himself to the floor. Andy Carroll equalised from the spot, cancelling out the goal I'd scored in the first half, and 2 minutes later, Aaron Cresswell made it 2-1 with a tremendous left-foot shot. As the ball arced over Kasper's head and into the top corner, I held my head in my hands. I felt angry and helpless. I wanted to chase a lost cause, make another run, force a mistake, throw myself at a cross. Yet all I could do was stand and watch. With the game deep into injury time, Becky headed back upstairs, leaving me alone in my thoughts. I knew that if we lost it, it would be seen by others as the moment when Leicester finally cracked. Yet I still hadn't given up on the game. Not with the spirit and fight in that group of players on the pitch. We'd proved time and again that we never knew when we were beaten, rescuing points from desperate situations, and even with 10 men, I thought we'd get another chance. What I didn't realise was that Moss had another controversial decision in him. After turning down our appeals for a Stonewall penalty, after Angelo Ogbonna had his arm around Houthi's neck, the West Ham centre-half did the same thing to me in the first half, the referee penalised Carroll for a foul on Jeff that was the softest call of the lot. It felt like a classic case of a referee deciding that two wrongs make a right. Not that I was complaining at this stage, of course. Leo, showing balls of steel, slotted home, and I jumped around in the dressing room like the Leicester fans I could hear behind the goal. Suddenly, it seemed like a point gained, and the mood among the lads when they got back into the dressing room was one of defiance. They were furious with the referee, who'd looked like a man in charge of a game that was too big for him. But the way we salvaged a draw gave everybody something positive to focus on. At home, that evening, I was thinking back over everything. Not just the red card, but the implications of it. I was going to be suspended for the visit of Swansea the following Sunday, and that made me feel like I'd let the lads down. I was missing at the critical stage of the season. I grabbed my phone and posted a message on the players' WhatsApp group. Sorry, boys. I'm gutted I won't be able to fight with you next week. The responses came thick and fast. Everybody was telling me that there was no need to apologise and, in a sign that the West Ham match had strengthened, not weakened our resolve, promised to hammer Swansea next week.
Jamie Vardy, the boy from nowhere. Available now on iTunes and Audible.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. No matter what you do or what industry you're in, how you communicate is key. Everything you type is equally important to collaboration, and Grammarly can help. Think of it as your AI writing partner, empowering you to communicate effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact in the workplace. 96% of Grammarly users say it helps them craft more impactful writing. And as the gold standard of responsible AI, Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. By understanding your writing in context, Grammarly provides relevant, personalized suggestions. And with tone suggestions, you can navigate even the most difficult work conversations. You can also save time from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds with one click. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember. Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with something, you know.
And then we'll weigh around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.